Welcome to The Edges of Lean. I'm Bella Engelbach, and in this podcast, we explore the human and creative side of lean thinking, unusual places where lean thinking is practiced. We meet people who are practicing continuous improvement in many different flavors and styles. So come along with me on a journey to the edges of lean. Episode 14, Continuous Improvement and Construction. Take a look at the building you're in. Foundation, walls, floors, roof, wiring, lighting, windows, doors, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, and so much more. So many components and so many people involved from design to delivery. It's nothing like a factory to build a new building. So you might think that there's not much opportunity to use lean thinking. But if you've been involved in construction in any way, you know that a lot of construction projects have problems. And lean, well, in lean we know something about solving problems. My guest today is Susan Reinhardt. Susan began her career as an architect in 1991, designing schools in Switzerland. She excels at managing complex projects with multiple stakeholders and has acted as project manager for public projects ranging from a $1.5 million mountain library to a $30 million recreation center to a $4 billion university in Saudi Arabia. Susan has developed a reputation for rescuing failing projects and bringing order out of chaos. She now coaches facility owners, designers, and contractors on lean methods for building projects up to $1 billion, including tool install design in a new semiconductor fabrication plant, pharmaceutical facilities, large historical renovation projects, education facilities, government office buildings, infrastructure projects, healthcare, and more. Susan Reinhardt, welcome to The Edges of Lean.
Thank you.
Susan, you are working in the building industry, and there's not a lot of people in lean and continuous improvement working in the building industry, and I think you're going to tell us more about that later, but I'd love to know about you. How did you get into this industry, and how did you get into continuous improvement?
Well, I'm an architect by profession, so I originally was looking into engineering fields, and that didn't excite me too much. But the notion of combining design and engineering was a really big draw for me. So I really jumped into my education, you know, when I was 17 and graduated, and actually my first job was in Switzerland because I took a semester abroad, and my mother is Swiss, so I started working in Switzerland for an architecture firm, and we did a lot of public work. So most of my career was doing public work, so civic center stuff. So the schools and libraries and universities and community recreation centers and the type of civil work that people were really excited about. So lots of different community members and a lot of different stakeholders, taxpayer money, and engineers. So that's been my life previously.
So really big projects.
I've done everything from $1 million mountain library to a $4 billion university in Saudi Arabia. So it's been a huge range of work that I'm involved in.
Well, I can't even imagine that, you know, doing a whole university, right? So that's really extraordinary. So somewhere along the way, you became interested in lean thinking and continuous improvement. How did that happen?
Well, I always had a kind of a project manager brain. I usually fulfilled both functions, project architect and project manager. And over time, I started being brought in as the person to fix things when projects were failing or flailing, or I was given the project if we had a difficult owner or it was really a low fee. So I began to come into a lot of different projects and try to help them right the ship, so to speak. And I got very interested in how do you do things correctly in the first place? So how do you make sure that you're not redoing a lot of your work? I mean, design work is iterative. We go back and we learn more and we add to what we've done. But there are negative iterations where you're just erasing what you've done and you're starting over, or a mismatch with your engineers, or a mismatch with the owner and user groups, and it gets messy. So I started writing out all these missives on how do you go through a project piece by piece by piece? How do you talk to the owners? How do you talk to your consulting engineers? How do you put together a series of pages? You know, we might have 100 architectural pages of 30 by 42, plus another 100 for the civil engineers and all the landscape and structural and mechanical, electrical engineers. Just a huge set, and that might be for a $25 million building. So how do we know it's easy to get around and contractors can find what they're looking for? So that's what I started doing, is saying, okay, this is how you go through a project. 1, 2, 3, 4. You don't miss anything. You don't have to rework. You don't have misunderstandings, and get things done on time. I think another characteristic I had was I didn't work overtime very much. So I was very, very jealous of my time. As an architect, of course, I'd roll into the office around 9 because we are not early risers. And I'd take an hour for lunch and I'd leave at 6. And because of that, I also got very efficient. It's like, if you're about to leave at 6 and it's 4 p.m., you don't dawdle. It's like, what do I need to do? What do I need to get done? And let's knock this out. So I was the go-to person for bringing order out of chaos. And that was my original interest.
So you got into it because you were already thinking about how do I reduce some of this chaos, and how do I put the, I guess, iteration in the right place, because you have to have iteration at the beginning, right? When you're coming up with your design. But over time, you've got to stop the iterations. You've got to move forward and execute.
Mm-hmm. And how do you positively add to the project rather than going down a rabbit hole and saying this didn't work and walking it back and redoing your work, or, you know, problems coordinating with engineers, and the owner looks at it and they don't really know what to say to your project. So that's a real interesting part of architecture. We tend to show 2D drawings and nobody knows what they're looking at, but they don't want to admit it. So we've tried more with three-dimensional drawings, but, you know, how do you make sure that the owner, when they're walking through the building, doesn't look at something and say, that's not what I thought I was getting.
It seems to me that the architect's vision, just the way the architect sees the building, has got to be different from the way that the owner sees the building, right? So there's a communication issue right there, just between the architect and the owner.
Certainly. And between the architect and the engineers, even within an architecture firm, the principal in charge who won the job and who has talked with the owner maybe for years, he kind of goes off to the periphery and the project architect takes over. So the question is, how much of that knowledge gets transferred? And that's another issue. And then when we have contractors on board, which often are not there at the beginning, what do they know about the why? Or are they just being told build this and not giving us their feedback?
And don't contractors also then have their own ideas about what might be the best way to do something?
Of course. and you hear a lot, well, if that's the way you want to do it, okay, that's not what I would have done. And of course, you know, architects have a decent understanding of a whole lot of subjects. We're the original jack of all trades, master of none. You know, we take tests on mechanical engineering and electrical engineering and pre-design and structures and earthquakes. We know just enough to be dangerous about any one subject. And we tend to not rely on our team members as much as we could for innovation.
Interesting. So you were doing this work, you were fixing other people's problems, you were trying to help them avoid rework. It sounds pretty lean to me, what you were working on and what you were moving towards. But you also then had some interesting experiences and learning that kind of pushed you down that path, I understand.
Yeah, and I actually got an MBA in 05 and 06 when I was formally introduced to lean. It was actually lean in hospital work. And instantly I looked at it and thought, oh my gosh, you know, I've been reinventing the wheel. This is great. You know, I looked into project management professional and PMI, and I enjoyed that too. It was all recognizable, but the lean thinking really turned my head. So I started trying to learn as much as I could, and how would that apply to building? Because it was almost unheard of, even just 4 or 5 years ago. People didn't even know what I was talking about in the building industry when I said lean. So it's pretty recent that it's exploded, and now people at least know what it is and are intrigued by it.
So can you remember what it was the first moment that you had that aha feeling, you know, that moment you said, oh, I've been reinventing it? What was it that you saw or that you were learning about that triggered that for you?
You know, I was a very good command and control architect, right? Like the superintendent on the job site, you order people around, you know what, you're the keeper of the flame, you know. But really it was the notion of how you work with different professionals and specialties in a way that brought in all their perspectives, and you could help guide and lead them and with the vision, but really, how do you get their assistance and really make use of the specialties that they know so much about? And that really, having a way to do that, I have engineering brain, so I am not necessarily the person to come up with the kumbaya HR, let's all work together now, people. So a lot of what I'm learning now, especially in the building industry, you could call it soft skills for engineers or contractors who are used to being command and control. And we realize we don't have to know everything. We can really rely on the people around us, but how do we get that information out of them? Because it's a very adversarial relationship. And I have been told by our insurers who came in and gave us lectures that the contractor controls the means and methods. Don't you dare ever imply that you're telling them how to do their work. And even if we're doing a walkthrough on site, they would say, you know, you have no right to talk to a sub. You can only talk to the general contractor, and he cannot talk to any of your engineers. He must go through you. And they said, well, okay, if you see scaffolding that's in imminent danger of collapse, you can say something. But other than that, you talk right to the GC and tell them what you've observed, but you don't mix in. So it's very adversarial. And trades are worried they're going to get blamed as well. And if there's a problem on the project, they'll have to pay up. And everybody is very careful about making sure they're not to blame for anything.
So that's a really hard culture to change then, that if a blame-based culture with fear of legal action and having to, you know, to make retribution for errors or mistakes, that is hard to turn around.
And safety is a big deal, right? Because people get hurt.
Yeah. So one of the things that I have noticed in, you know, just nothing like building a civic center or a university, but just in terms of when we built our own house, was how many different contractors were involved. So we were actually surprised many times, you know, to come to the site and see the house being built and find, you know, people there who were completely different from the people who had been there the day before. And there were several times that we, as the owners, I think made mistakes because we didn't know actually sort of what order things were going to happen, you know. So even though I think they tried to explain it to us, but it must be on a big project, it must be even more parties to deal with.
It's literally a cast of thousands, many of whom are working there for the first time. So, you know, you might have typically 50 to 60 subcontractors working under a general contractor, and all of them have their own suppliers and vendors. And these could be literally thousands of people. And if there's a hitch in the project, right, and you show up with six painters, but nothing is ready to paint, well, next week, you're going to show up with one. He's going to be a scout. He's going to look. He's going to say, okay, they have work for us, so now we'll come. But maybe those are the six different painters. And so you really have people, like you said, they go out and they get labor because they have this big influx of work to do. And that may not be the type of people who have been working on that project before. So they also need an education of exactly where everything is and what the point is. And of course, everyone is a different company. I think everyone's, we're used to having different silos in a company, different departments that don't talk to each other. But these are different companies. You know, hundreds of different companies with their own profit and loss statements and their own way of doing business. And they all want to make sure that they're making a profit. And that's true with architects. We have our consulting engineers are not in-house. We have our favorites and we bring them on board, but this can be different people. And the owner is not just an owner. They have many different user groups. If you think of a healthcare institution, they've got the doctors, the nurses, the orderlies, the people who do maintenance, the people who bring in supplies, the CFO, the COO. They just have a lot of different groups, including their patients. And so the owner is not an owner. It's many different stakeholders and they don't always agree.
Well, it was definitely true when we were building our house that my husband and I did not always agree.
Exactly.
So I can only imagine that, you know, multiplied by, you know, hundreds or thousands of times. So what have you been learning and working on and bringing to the industry to help to solve some of these really challenging issues?
Well, we have our founding fathers of Lean and construction, of course. And I worked with one of them while I was working at Lean Project Consulting, but Glenn Ballard and Greg Howell were kind of the founding fathers of Lean in building. And they had a company, I understand, that was about productivity in construction. So they'd show up and your carpenters are too slow. They'd have a stop motion camera and they'd find really good ways to increase the productivity of that contractor. But what they were finding is that had literally zero impact on the project as a whole. So the bottleneck just moved somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think they were asked to create a productivity manual and they just kind of shook their heads and said, well, what we're doing isn't really working for us. So they decided to take a different tactic and they went on site a bunch of different projects that were on time, on budget, good contractors. And they started asking the superintendent, how many tasks do you intend to get done this week? And they just count them up and make a list. And then they come back at the end of the week and say, how many of these tasks did you actually get done? And the answer, they called it pi. It's like, this was almost a constant number. It was about 54%.
So you got half the work done that they expected to do. Consistently, week after week.
Exactly. And yet they were on time and on budget, as I understand it. So we're literally planning into, you know, kind of baking into the cake, not getting half done of what you expected. And if you have different companies that are expecting to follow in sequence, you think of contractors as marching in a line through a project, that causes all sorts of havoc. So they decided, what if we had the best week ever? What if we could find a way to coordinate amongst ourselves so that everybody could do that week's worth of work the way they intended? And that was the birth of the Last Planner system, which is kind of the foundational lean method that we use in the building industry, and which actually has implications for any project-based work when you're trying to coordinate among specialists.
So how does the Last Planner system work then?
It's basically five levels. So they started out with the weekly work plan. Right. But then I guess the question is, are they following it day to day? So we have daily huddles. That's another level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the last time for a subcontractor to say, look, we're going to be in this room tomorrow and you've got a load of drywall there. So can you please move it? I mean, these last minute adjustments. We also ask and try to learn. This is our PDCA cycle. So if you couldn't do a task today that you planned to, why not? We kind of record why not. And we're trying to gather variances so that we can clear them in the future. But of course, it often happens that constraints appear. You don't have the right information. You don't have the right materials or manpower. So how do we make sure we can clear constraints? Because if you're going to be starting a task on Thursday and it's Monday and you don't have what you need, it's a scramble.
Right.
Then, that is a firefighting, right? So you go up, you say, okay, if we looked about 6 weeks in the future, we're pretty sure we're going to be doing that work. And let's ask ourselves, are there any constraints? So if we need information from the architect, let's ask for it now. So we have it before that task comes in. But then I guess the question is for the next level, in phase planning, is that 6 week look ahead accurate? A lot of these schedules happen because general contractors put them together with no sub input. So now we're looking at a phase plan. How are we going to reach a milestone like steel and foundation package, or the building is dried in so we can start interiors? That's a phase. And how do we look at the overall milestones? So we have at the top, you know, not a lot of detail, the milestones at the top, and those define our phases. In which case we bring in all the trades that are going to reach that phase of, well, we're dried in and we're going to start interiors by August 15th. And what we do is a technique called pull planning. So we get everyone in a room and the general contractor usually has an idea. I think this is how we're going to reach this stage. We're going to start in the north. We're going to move to the west. This is how fast we're going to go. And he presents his idea because you need something to work with. We call that the last plan or the worst plan you could ever leave with, right? Because he's got an idea. And then we go by trade, by trade, by trade. How did you think you were going to do this work? What sequence do you need? How are you going to work with your other contractors? How fast can you go? Can we break this work up into smaller bites and turn over work to the next trade faster? And they start to know about each other's work that they didn't understand before. I was working on a GSA office building renovation, and they were bringing in someone who did manufactured walls and floors. Well, nobody really knew how they worked. So the question is, you know, do you want the ceilings up before you bring in the walls? You know, who's pulling the wire to the floor boxes? You are the electrician. And they had that chance to just bandy about what are we doing? What sequence? And sometimes they have to completely change what they're doing.
Because it wasn't going to work.
It wasn't compatible. You know, someone was going to bring all the mechanical racks that they had built for their equipment. They were going to put it down in a hole in the floor and bring it to the basement. And the structural people say, wait a minute, we're going to fill in that hole in 3 weeks so that we can do the structure above it. So we better figure out how you can bring in those racks differently. And sometimes they literally go walk out on the site in the middle of a pull plan and say, okay, you know, if we put this wall down into the stairwell, we can actually get it in and then build that wall easily. So these are the types of horse trading things we talk about. And then we start with our sticky notes. As you know, lean consultants all love stickies. And you can have a sticky note. So this is the task in a certain area. So we do swim lanes by area. This is how long it's going to take me. And this is my trigger. So this is the last thing I need to see before I'll go in and do my work from another trade. And we start at the milestone and we actually go backwards at this point. So we say, okay, who has the last task where we can finally say we're ready to start interiors and dried in? And that kind of people hem and haw. And finally somebody says, I think I have it. They go up, they put up their sticky and they say, this is what I'm doing. This is how long it'll take. And this is what I need from someone else. And that becomes a collaborative thing. So we build backwards, concentrating on those handoffs. And nobody can move anyone else's sticky. So if you realize they've forgotten your water vapor barrier, you have to speak up and you go to the board with the others and you rearrange it. And we look at it in that fashion. So that's our phase plan. So now we have a phase plan for about the next 3 months. We go down into make ready. So we open a window on that phase plan. In 6 weeks, we're going to order the windows. All right. So do we have everything we need to order the windows? So as that task starts to advance closer and closer to the weekly work plan, we know that everything is clear and constraint free. So we have our weekly work plan, the best week ever, and then we status it daily. So we have these meetings. They're very quick. The daily huddle is maybe 15 minutes. The weekly work plan is maybe an hour. A pull planning session can be 2 to 4 hours. And we have a very good idea of how we're going to do the work. And those are the five levels. So there are five levels of conversation. We say nothing gets done in human endeavor except through conversation. And these are artifacts that tell us how we're going to get things done. And everybody knows. And it's the people, you know, you ask, what is last planner exactly? That's an individual. That's usually the foreman who is at the site, at the workplace. He's ordering manpower and materials. Although now we're starting to think, well, what about the crew? You know, the crew doesn't just accept what the foreman says. They're saying, okay, we need sleeves in this concrete slab for various, you know, electrical conduit or whatever. And they're discussing with other crews. So when you really look at it, there's a lot of people at the workplace who really know what needs to be done, but may not speak up. So that is how we're trying to marshal all of their expertise. But it's a complicated system, but it works. If you're in the design phase, of course, you know, you can imagine contractors marching in a line, right? Mm-hmm. So front to back, and one stops, everybody else piles up. Or if he runs ahead, he tramples the people ahead of him and nobody can catch up, right? In design, it's a little different, right? We're marching shoulder to shoulder, and we look to the left, we look to the right, and we see all these specialists, and we kind of need to advance together and finish, you know, cross that finish line together.
Together, yeah.
So we slightly do things differently. We might do pull plans in 2 to 3 week cycles. So we have our milestone plan and phase plan, and every 2 to 3 weeks, we do a pull plan because we have to coordinate our work that much more closely. So there's little tweaks that we do.
Susan, one of the things that strikes me about this is you started out talking about how you were trained as an architect and as an engineer to have engineering brain, as you said, to not think about the people thing. But what you're saying now is in order to actually have the best week ever and a series of those best weeks, which result in building being delivered on time and on our budget and presumably none of those things that you find kind of at the final walkthrough where you go, oh my goodness, you know, there was supposed to be something here, it's not here. That is bringing together a lot of people, many of whom were trained like you or are dealing with these, you know, these situations of having been, you know, had a career in a blame environment or where people don't talk to each other because this kind of person just doesn't talk to that kind of person. So what are you doing to overcome all of that culture that is presumably working against you?
Well, sometimes it's tough. I mean, oftentimes consultants are brought in, I'm sure you know, when things are not going well. So instead of saying, let's get off on the right foot, it's like, ooh, this is really not going well. We're not going to make our target, help. And we come in, there's just a huge lack of trust. And people are upset. People may have been blamed. You know, they say, oh, the drywaller is taking too long. Well, the drywaller is like, well, we're moving right behind the people we need to move behind. And it's really hard to tell where the problem lies with so many people involved. So one of those things that we need to do is kind of back off at that point, because if you try to introduce change in a team that's not trusting anyone, that becomes difficult. So as we're training people, we like to do training and then coach them on the job. We really like to emphasize, we want you to tell us what you need. So just imagine a world where you can show up on site, you have access to where you need to be, that area. People are out of your way. The materials are easily accessible. How can we help you do your job in the best manner possible? So one thing we notice is people will come up and say, well, it's going to take me 2 weeks to drill all these caissons, when you really know it's going to take him one. And you have to be careful how you're questioning that. You might say, do you really want to spend 10 days on that task? Wouldn't you rather spend 5? What do we need to give you to make sure that you can work in the manner you want to work in? And one thing we often do, which might seem strange, is we take a mood check-in of people in meetings, and we say, what is your mood today? And it's not just good or bad. It's, well, I'm frustrated, I'm cynical, I'm skeptical, I'm ambitious, I'm curious. We want to know why. And behind those moods is usually an assessment. It's like, nobody listens to me, nobody will listen to me in the future, and this is not going to change. And that puts you in a certain mood. And that means that you're going to behave in a certain way. So what we try to do is get an understanding of the team and of their assessments of each other. Assessments are neither right nor wrong. They may be grounded in fact or not. What is your assessment? Because if the superintendent walks in and says, this project is going to be 2 months late, people don't hear that as his opinion. They hear that as a fact, and they become discouraged. And so we really look at that language piece and say, let's stop that. Let's say that this is an assessment. It is only an assessment. We can have assessments of our team members. They may or may not be grounded in reality. And let's see how we can better work together. And there's a technique we use. It's called Conversations for Action. We stole it from Fernando Flores. And that is, how do we actually get commitments from each other? I'm sure you've been in meetings where people are talking and talking and talking. Nothing gets done. And the next week, they're talking about the same thing. So we have a commitment loop. And what that is somebody has a request, whether it's get me a cup of coffee or build me a 100-bed hospital tower. And they have to prepare. What do they actually want? What do they think they can get? They have to prepare. They have to think about it. Then they make the request. I would like X. And that's really the last planner system. I would like the plumber to rough in his work so that I can follow him with electrical conduit. You know, we're making a request. And the performer just doesn't say, okay, I'll do that and run off and do the work. The performer says, okay, it's a negotiation. Let's negotiate the conditions of satisfaction that will please you and me. How are we going to work together? Do I have the time? Do I have the expertise? Can I get it? How can I do this work? Do I know how to do it? Do I have everything I need from others? And there's a negotiation back and forth. And we come up with the conditions of satisfaction. You know, this is what the customer says. If you give me this, I'll be satisfied. And a date. And then we go into execution mode. And then the performer says, okay, formally, I'm finished. They hand over the finished product or service. And the customer has to say, yes, I'm satisfied, or no, that's not what I really had in mind. And that's how the loop is closed when they're finally satisfied. So we try to train people to realize where they are in a conversation and to realize weasel words. Like, well, I plan to do this, or I hope to do that. And the question is, why are you planning? Why are you planning to give me the structural calculations by next week? Why aren't you saying I will? And so we kind of have fun with it. We have little clickers, like those dog clickers. Every time somebody says, hopefully, or it's in the schedule, or I plan to, we click. And we say, well, you will or you won't, or I will if you give me this. And if the answer is no, and this is the hardest thing in the world, people to say, no, I can't get you the windows by August 15th. It's just not going to happen. But we want to know that as early as they know that, and not just have them crossing their fingers and thinking, well, I hope they don't need them, or I hope a miracle occurs. But when you hear no, the question is, okay, so where do we go from here? If we can't get the windows, can we have temporary enclosures so we can start the framing and drywall? What do we need? And so this is something that, as those commitments start being worked out and fulfilled and people understand each other, trust is built. So promises that are kept builds trust. we really spent a lot of time with the superintendents who, you know, they kind of see our way of working is, well, I'm going to make sure that they're accountable, right? And well, it's not really accountability. It's feedback. Can they get better? And what are they trying to tell us? And allow them to tell you these things rather than running around fighting fires.
Wow. So you really are working towards changing a culture.
Yes.
And I think that's fantastic. And it takes us back again to, I think, what almost every one of these podcasts comes to, which is that at the heart, it really is all about people, right? It is really all about people. And you can have the best tools and the best planning system or the best 5S or whatever it is that you're working on, if you're not really, really working with people, really, really having respect for people, it's never going to work. Now, you're doing this. So you're doing these projects and you complete the project. What happens at the end of the project? Everybody just goes away, right?
We move on. In fact, you know, trades might be there in the beginning and not at the end, right? If you're still a rector, you're not there at the end. So yeah, there's a ribbon cutting, hopefully for the owner, and we help them move in, and then poof, we're on to the next project, especially designers.
So hopefully all of those people that you've been training and working with and teaching and coaching are going to other projects and hopefully bringing some of that with them, you know, hopefully it becomes viral and people come back asking for more of it.
That's our goal.
So Susan, thinking, you know, you've just had this really interesting career starting out as in architecture. You're still in the, I think, the same industry, but looking at it in such a different way. What would be your advice to a young person now, you know, starting out in their career, particularly if they're coming out of a STEM program?
Well, I think it's becoming more and more common to teach lean methods and collaboration. So I'm pretty hopeful there. And I would say, though, that there's so much you can learn. You know, I've enjoyed the same organization you have, Women in Lean, where I'm moving outside of my industry. And so many things that manufacturing or service industries have to teach us that we're sometimes not willing to learn. I think young people are much more willing to look for advice elsewhere. I know that LEI, the Lean Enterprise Institute, you know, their lean product and process development is something that's inspired me greatly. So we have something called Target Value Delivery that's based on that. Mm-hmm. So I would say to young people, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Think of this as one really large customized product. It stays in place while the assembly line moves, right? What can we learn from others and how can you be valuable? I get this question from trades who say, well, my general contractor isn't lean. What can I do? I can't really push it. And I say, well, you can plan your own work using these methods. And the more you understand what you need, the more you can make relevant requests of others. Or the people on your crew, if the GC says, well, I want you to suddenly build caissons over in that corner and not where you plan to, you can say, well, okay, but you understand where you are in the schedule and you understand the impact and you can have a dialogue, whereas most will just take the orders and do it. But how can you be that valuable person, the one who raises the good questions, the one who coordinates with others, and that will be noticed by people you're working for?
I think that's really good advice. And particularly when I think of a young person starting out in particular their first or their second job, there might be a tendency to say, well, let me just learn this job and just follow the orders. But every industry, every workplace needs people who can see connections and bring people together and help people work together more effectively. Yeah. If you were starting over again, what would you do differently? Is there anything you'd do differently?
I don't know. I mean, I worked in a series of small offices You know, most offices are small. Actually, I think when I got my license in California, they said 60% of architects are sole proprietors.
Oh, wow. So,
but, you know, I also worked in a 1,700 person office, which was pretty big. So I think what's great about being in a small office is that you can talk to the boss directly, mm-hmm. have a much clearer vision of what's going on. So I could ask questions and I could take on tasks. I could say, I can see you're busy. Why don't I go meet with the code official? Or maybe I can go to the meeting with the contractor, or maybe I can go to the site and do the overview in the construction meeting. So it really allowed me to take on a lot more responsibility. Whereas in a larger office, you get to be doing door details or massing diagrams for months, right? And you don't get to do construction administration. Mm-hmm. So I felt what I did was pretty good. I wish target value delivery and choosing my advantages and last planner system were something I grew up with. They weren't. Mm-hmm. We had our own ways of command and control. And I, like I said, I was good at it. But, you know, I can see now that I could have gotten much more use out of my engineers, right? Because they would present me with a solution and I didn't know how they reached it. Maybe it was something we'd done before because we worked together. And we didn't really stop and say, wait a minute, if you had your druthers, what would be the best way as a mechanical engineer to do this work? And I certainly never had a subcontractor, literally the mechanical subcontractor, who could say, wait a minute, this is how I really install it. Give me the calculations and I can give you the best mechanical system ever. And that kind of dialogue is something that I really look back on and think, wow, we missed the boat.
Yeah, I think the same thing about my career, you know, obviously in a very different industry in the pharmaceutical industry, but certainly when I started out, there was very much a sense that you sort of didn't talk to people in other departments. You kind of did your own work and somehow magically it all came together. I think there's a lot of, you know, hopefully it'll come together.
Throw it over the wall.
Throwing it over the wall. And, you know, one of the things that was really helpful to me, it was actually just was coffee breaks. I don't know if people get to do coffee breaks anymore, especially with everybody working at home. But the coffee break and sitting down and talking to somebody who was in a different department and finding out what they did, you know, those things are so important, right? Those opportunities just to see how it all connects.
Right. And for an architect to walk the site. You know, so many don't get the chance. They don't ask questions. And contractors often won't tell you. You put the same design in your documents over and over again. You don't realize they're pulling their hair out.
Every single
time. You don't
time.
See it for yourself. And yeah, if they could be there in the beginning. And, you know, architects are a bit protective. They're like, well, I don't have time to involve my mechanical engineer, let alone my sub. I got to get this floor plan done. And I got to get the owner to sign on the dotted line and say, that's it. So I can get my engineers going. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you're cutting off your creativity here. What if you explored multiple sets with all these disciplines where you can come to the owner and you've really learned something and you could say, well, we have a bunch of options and this is what they solve. These are the issues and we've heard you. We know what your conditions of satisfaction are. And, you know, they say that in the first 10% of design, 70% of costs and sustainability and scope are already determined, right? You've got your massing and orientation. You've got your big systems in there. And if you're bringing on your contractor after that, that is a huge number, you know, a huge amount of expertise that you know, they can only play around the edges. So, you know, this notion of bringing in groups and cross-functional teams and really studying the mechanical system, really studying the building envelope and how they relate to each other and having a constant cost estimate so that we know, you know, where we are. We usually put out documents we've been working on for 3 months and they price them, they're way over, and then we go into these destructive value engineering cycles where we take scope out.
take things out because they're too expensive.
Yeah, yeah. And we could have done it another way, right?
Right. Because you probably weren't even sure what it was that people were looking for to start with.
Right. So it's, you know, having that ability to bring all these specialists together and to understand the different systems and how they're compatible and look at different options, it's actually faster because we don't find all these clashes mm-hmm. that we then have to fix. You know, we come together, we make a decision, we design to those decisions. So, you know, this is really in project-based work. You know, we are the original project-based industry. You know, we're spending $500 million on a building that's going to last you 100 years. You kind of start learning these different techniques, and I'm really excited. I think Lean will revolutionize the building industry.
That's really cool. And I'm also thinking, you know, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about how Toyota trains chief engineers, which is to bring them up and to have the opportunity to have expertise, deep expertise in one area, but have the opportunity to work in other areas and understand how the other areas work. So when they become a chief engineer, they are able to have those conversations and bring all those different functions together. And it sounds mm-hmm. to me, Susan, as if what you are creating in the way that you work is almost like the chief engineer for a building, right? Which is not quite the same as the architect, right? The chief engineer may not actually be the designer, but the chief engineer is the one who can bring together all of the functions mm-hmm. in the right time, in the right place to deliver what the customer really wants.
Right, so. And make sure everybody knows what the why is. I teach for the Associate General Contractors, a CM Lean certification course, and we have a pre-construction. That's what they call design.
Pre-construction.
Yeah. Yeah, and we you know, architects are notorious for not putting enough money into our construction administration fund and disappearing on contractors because we're off to the next shiny new object. But, you know, it's funny to have all these contractors and I make them do a design problem. And at the end of it, they come back and they go, my goodness, it's so easy to build something the customer doesn't want. You know, and that why, which they usually, oh, that's your job, you know. But understanding the why is just huge. And I think people want to be building something worthwhile. And of course, everyone in the building industry, we have the best job in the world. We get to see our work, you know, 10 stories high in concrete and steel. It's results. You can drive by it with your kids and said, you know, say, Dad did that. So it's, you know, making it less painful is something that I hear about with Lean. I mean, there are trades who will say, I won't do any job that's not a last planner job, right? You see architects saying, I will always bring in, you know, target value delivery, even if we don't have an integrated project delivery contract, but a traditional one. And it just makes things so much easier. You know, the superintendents say there used to be like 10 foremen stacked outside my office at 6 a.m. when I got there in the morning. Now they know what to do. They're coordinating with each other. I can get my work done. I can plan other things and I can go home at a reasonable time. And it's not a game of telephone running from one sub to the next and hearing all their problems. So, you know, it's great to come in and see a Lean implementation and just see how the people just kind of relax, like, oh, yeah, this is going well. And owners, I used to work with owners that weren't used to building. If you're in the Parks and Rec and all of a sudden you've got $20 million to build a recreation center, that's a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And how can we make sure that they know their tax dollars are well spent and they're happy with the end results. So yeah, I'm really excited about Lean, especially in this project-based environment. And yes, it is possible to increase your creativity. Whereas this is not just reindustrializing a process. This is really mm-hmm. about creativity.
Wow, thank you. Susan Reinhardt, how can people find you?
I am on I'm on LinkedIn. So if you look at Susan Reinhardt, Reinhardt Lean Design and Consulting, I would love especially to talk to other people, other lean people in other industries who might be interested in trying out some of the methods we've used and developed in the building industry and kind of learning from each other. So I think there are a lot of great systems that we've developed that work very well in project-based work that people outside of Lean have never heard of. So I would love to have kind of that cross, what is it, intercultural exchange?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. And it, Susan at yourleanproject.com. That's another way to get in touch with me.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for being a guest on and traveling with me to the edges of Lean.
And thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Susan Reinhardt for being my guest on The Edges of Lean. Please reach out to Susan for some more cross-cultural communication between your Lean community and the world of Lean construction. Please join me in exploring more of The Edges of Lean. There's a lot to learn. And check out my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com. You'll find more podcasts and videos with lots of great new content every week. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelbach. This is a Lean for Humans production.